It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Well, you're renting an apartment or a house to serve as your home, so of course you're allowed to have company and to have guests and visitors. While they're there, you're responsible for their behavior, so you'd want to make sure that your guests and visitors don't cause problems or do things that are forbidden by the lease, like causing a lot of noise or have illegal activity going on, because you would be responsible for them even if you, in some cases, didn't even know about that activity. So that's something to be really careful about. You wouldn't want to lose your right to live in the dwelling place because of activity of your guests or visitors.
Landlord-tenant attorney Beth Godwin-Jones talks about an important source of a tenant's legal rights and responsibilities, your lease. What's in there and what does it mean? And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn about the Federal Trade Commission's new legal action against unlawful payday lenders and how you can file a complaint with the FTC. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 164, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. The Federal Trade Commission has taken action against a payday lending operation that allegedly piled on undisclosed and inflated fees and collected on loans illegally by threatening borrowers with arrest and lawsuits. Like other payday lenders in recent years, this operation has claimed in state legal proceedings that it is affiliated with Native American tribes and therefore immune from legal action. However, the FTC alleges that the defendant's claims of tribal affiliation do not exempt them from complying with federal law. This is the second time in 7 months that the FTC has brought suit against a payday lender that has used a tribal affiliation defense against actions by state authorities. The FTC recently expanded its first such case against Payday Financial LLC, adding charges that the operation illegally sued debt-burdened consumers in a South Dakota tribal court that did not have jurisdiction over their cases. In the present case, the FTC filed a complaint in U.S. District Court charging that a web of defendants, including AMG Services, Inc., three other internet-based lending companies, seven related companies, and six individuals, violated federal law by deceiving consumers when providing and collecting on payday loans. The defendants claimed that they would charge borrowers the amount borrowed plus a one-time finance fee. Instead, the FTC alleges, the defendants made multiple withdrawals from borrowers' bank accounts and assessed a new finance fee each time without disclosing the true costs of the loan. The defendants also falsely threatened that consumers could be arrested, prosecuted, or imprisoned for failing to pay and that the defendants would sue them if they did not pay. According to documents filed by the FTC, over the last 5 years, the defendants' deceptive and illegal tactics have generated more than 7,500 complaints to law enforcement authorities. In many cases, the defendants' inflated fees left borrowers with supposed debts of more than triple the amount they had borrowed. The FTC's complaint alleges that defendants' misrepresentations and false threats violated the Federal Trade Commission Act, violated the Truth in Lending Act by failing to accurately disclose the annual percentage rate, and violated the Electronic Fund Transfer Act by illegally requiring consumers to pre-authorize electronic fund transfers from their accounts. To file a complaint with the FTC, visit their online complaint assistant at www.ftccomplaintassistant.gov or call toll-free at 1-877-FTC-HELP. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Kaufman versus Bowen. In 1981, Junior Kaufman, then 56 years old, applied for Social Security disability benefits. He had an eighth-grade education and had worked in the coal mines for over 30 years. His treating physician said he had far-advanced degenerative changes throughout his spine and rheumatoid arthritis, and concluded that without any question he was totally and permanently disabled for any occupation anyone might reasonably expect him to pursue. However, a Social Security consultative doctor reported that Mr. Kaufman was disabled only for heavy work. The claim was denied by both Social Security and the United States District Court, but the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed. The appeals court observed that the attending physician's rule requires the opinion of a claimant's treating physician be given great weight and may be disregarded only if there is persuasive contradictory evidence. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault. And Kaufman versus Bowen is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the Carytown Law Office in Carytown, and we are speaking with Beth Godwin-Jones, a landlord-tenant attorney, and we're going to be speaking today about understanding your lease. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Thanks, Marty. It's great to be with you.
It's good to have you here. Tell us, Beth, when a tenant signs a lease, and most leases are in writing, what does signing a lease really mean?
Well, when you sign the lease, Marty, you're assumed, that's a fiction that the law creates, that you're assumed to have read and understood the lease. That's true with any contract or anything that you sign. So it's really important that a tenant have the opportunity to look through the lease and make sure that they understand it before they sign, because you couldn't then afterwards use a defense of not having read or understood it. You're blocked by that in the law.
Now, what happens if there's a difference between what is in writing and what's oral? I mean, during the lease formation process, the landlord could perhaps say things that the landlord is going to do or that are going to be terms of the lease agreement, but they're not written in the lease. What happens in that situation?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question and the source of some confusion I encountered and misunderstanding. But the terms that are in the written lease are always going to trump any conversation that you would have had when you were signing the lease. So it's important that the written terms of the lease reflect your understanding and that any additional terms that you've agreed on with the landlord also be put in writing. That happens sometimes in the form of repairs that are supposed to be made or upgrades. So there can easily be a misunderstanding between what's in the lease and what's said. And because of that, the law is going to favor the written terms over the oral agreement. So if you have any oral agreements with the landlord, you'd want to make sure that those were put down in writing as well.
Now, of course, in a city or an urban area, most leases are in writing, but I gather there's no requirement that a lease be in writing. There can be oral leases. They're unusual in this area, but they do occur. If there is an oral lease, then how does either party really prove or know what the terms are?
Yeah, that's a good question. We do have mostly written leases around the Richmond area, but it's possible to have an oral lease, and the problem is exactly what you've mentioned. How do you know what the terms are when it's not written down in black and white that either party can refer to easily and that the judge can look at and interpret? So in that case, you would have to rely on the course of conduct between the parties. For instance, if you've paid $500 a month rent for 6 months, it would be hard for you now in the seventh month to say, oh, well, it was really only supposed to be $400. Court is going to have to look at factors like that in interpreting the terms of an oral agreement.
Okay, now going back to written agreements, a lot of the standard agreements talk about joint and several liability of the tenant for the rent and for living up to the lease. What does joint and several liability mean?
Yes, that's also a source of a lot of confusion. If you sign a lease with another person, you may have an arrangement between the two of you that you're going to pay half and the other person is going to pay half. And so that's your arrangement with your co-tenant. But as between the two of you and the landlord's not bound by that arrangement. Both of you are responsible for payment in full of any money that's due under the lease, regardless of any side agreement that you may have. And so that means that you couldn't say, for instance, to the landlord and use it as a defense, I've paid my half, but he or she hasn't paid her half, the landlord can look to you for payment in full of the total rent.
Now, leases have lots and lots of different provisions in them. We certainly can't cover all of them in this interview, but we'll talk about some of the more important ones, and I guess one of the biggest ones that usually comes up early in the lease has to do with late fees. First of all, is this even governed by the Code of Virginia, or is this something strictly between the landlord and the tenant?
Yeah, the late fees really are governed by the lease. That's kind of surprising, I believe, that the law doesn't specifically address late fees, but there's no restriction or no requirement. The only thing is that late fees do have to be provided for in a written lease. You have to agree to those in writing. So if you have one of those oral leases, the landlord wouldn't be able to enforce a late fee against you. But other than that, as a general rule, the lease is going to determine what the amount is. Now, some courts have their own restrictions that they've imposed. They feel like there should be some kind of a cap on the late fees, but that's really just varies from court to court.
Well, and can you give us an example of a court that has imposed its own restriction on late fees?
The one that comes to mind is City of Richmond used to have a limit. It's been modified a couple of times. It used to be, I believe, $25 way back in the day when I started practicing landlord-tenant law, and then it was increased to 10%.
Now, some leases, not a large number, but some leases provide for what they call a per diem late fee. That is, there's an additional late fee added on for each day per diem that the rent is due. Do you find that judges generally will enforce those, will not enforce those? Does that vary court by court, judge by judge?
Yeah, I find that varies but according to the court. Some courts will enforce that. Other places consider that too high. And again, you got to keep in mind that it depends on what the monthly rent is as well. So that's just something to look at according to the court and even according to the judge.
Now, another thing that leases typically cover is who gets to live there and also who gets to come and visit. What is the general rule about a tenant being allowed to have guests and visitors?
Well, you're renting an apartment or a house to serve as your home. So, of course, you're allowed to have company and to have guests and visitors. While they're there, you're responsible for their behavior, so you'd want to make sure that your guests and visitors don't cause problems or do things that are forbidden by the lease, like causing a lot of noise or have illegal activity going on, because you would be responsible for them even if you in some cases didn't even know about that activity. So that's something to be really careful about. You wouldn't want to lose your right to live in the dwelling place because of activity of your guests or visitors. The length of time that they're allowed to stay is sometimes addressed in the lease, and in that case you'd want to make sure that you understand what that is. You may have to report a guest to the office just so that they know who's on the property and not. And another thing to keep in mind is that there may be some parking restrictions, so you may need to register that vehicle so it doesn't get towed. And so it's always a tricky thing to determine at what point a guest becomes more than a guest. And that's something that you'd probably want to discuss with the manager, just so that they agree and they know what's going on. They can often work with you to address that.
And that, of course, leads to the question of the guest or visitor becoming a problem. I gather that the landlord has a process by which a guest or visitor can be barred or banned from the premises. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, I can. If there's some objectionable conduct by the guest or the visitor, the management can serve them with a bar notice telling them that they're not allowed to be on the premises. And if they come and are caught on the premises, after having been served with that bar notice, they could be subject to arrest for trespass. The landlord can then provide a copy of the bar notice to the tenant. And in that case, if you have been served with a copy of that bar notice, you could risk losing your place to live if you allow that person to come to your property, your apartment, or your house after receiving that notice. And you could also be subject to a charge of aiding and abetting the crime of trespass. So if you've gotten one of those notices, you want to make sure that honor those so that you don't jeopardize your right to live there.
Now, one of the issues of a tenant's right to live is the right to have the peaceful and quiet use and enjoyment of the premises. Sometimes that phrase is specifically in the lease. Other times it's not, but it's implied by law. What does that actually mean?
Right, that's one of those sort of vague terms in the law, sort of like what is a reasonable person, what's the right to quiet enjoyment. A lot of landlords have rules and regulations that govern specific behaviors that are or are not allowed. Usually it has to deal with noise. That's probably the biggest problem. Because keep in mind, if you're living in an apartment complex, especially, you have a lot of people living in close proximity. So the idea is that you want to be able to enjoy your home, and you want to respect the rights of other people to also be able to enjoy living in their home as well. So this is sort of a right and a responsibility for a tenant. You have the right to have a quiet and peaceful place to live, as opposed to the other tenants, and not have a lot of parties and noise, illegal activity going on in the area. And that you have a right to enforce that right against the landlord, so that if there are objectionable behaviors going on and you report them to the landlord's duty then is to address those issues with the people who are causing the problems, so that you can be feeling quiet and enjoy your property just like you want to. But you also have a responsibility yourself not to cause any behaviors yourself that would interfere with the rights of your neighbors to enjoy the peace and quiet of their own home. And so you may get a notice yourself if you have a loud party or if you have some other problem in your apartment. You may receive a notice from your landlord telling that you need to correct that activity, or you could be removed from your apartment as well.
Now, one aspect of the tenant's right to use and enjoyment is the fact that it is their home, but at the same time, they don't own it. The landlord owns it, and of course, the landlord has a right, after following certain rules, to access the premises. Would you tell us what those rules are about the landlord's right to access the premises and the tenant's responsibility to provide access?
Yeah, that's another case, I believe, where you have a right and a responsibility, as does the landlord. The tenant has to cooperate with the landlord if there are certain repairs that need to be taken, or routine maintenance such as changing furnace filters perhaps, or checking the smoke detector batteries to make sure that they're operational. Some of these obligations are imposed by law, and the landlord really has to do that. And it's in the tenant's interest to have those matters addressed, because those are safety matters for the tenant. So you have a duty to provide the landlord with reasonable access to take care of the landlord's maintenance responsibilities. But the landlord also has an obligation not to be too annoying or overbearing in the performance of those duties. In other words, it is your home, and you have the right to live there without the landlord constantly knocking on your door wanting to come in for this or for that. So the landlord can't go overboard, and they can't just be spying on you through the guise of supposed maintenance requests. That has to be reasonable on the part of both parties. And this is an area where the law assumes a sort of a good faith cooperation between the parties in the best interests of everybody, the landlord's interest in maintaining the property and the tenant's interest in having a peace and quiet and not being overburdened by these intrusions by the landlord.
Now, we talked at the beginning about the formation of a lease. Let's talk about what happens at the end of the lease period and how a lease either gets renewed or maybe doesn't get renewed.
That's a good question, too, and there's often some confusion about that. It's possible that the lease just simply ends and there's no automatic renewal provision, and in that case, it goes month to month until one party gives a 30 days notice. But most frequently, a lease will have a built-in automatic renewal term just to make it easy for everybody. And so in that case, as the tenant, you want to make sure that you've checked that out, because the term isn't set by law. It could be 30 days, it could be 60 days, and in some cases, it's even 90 days. So if you're planning on moving out of the apartment or the property at the end of the lease, you want to make sure that you know what your lease says and that you provide the appropriate notice. Otherwise, it could renew for whatever period. Again, that's not set by the law. It's whatever is in the lease. It can renew for the same term, so for another year. Most generally, leases are in the term and go in year terms. Or it could renew for 30 days or for 60 days. So it's important that you know what is in your lease.
So it sounds as if most terms that govern a landlord-tenant relationship really are not set down in the Code of Virginia, but rather they're set forth in that lease. What happens, though, if there is a difference between what is in the lease and something that is either required by the Code of Virginia or that is forbidden by the Code of Virginia? What controls?
Right. Well, that's sort of difficult to answer because it depends on what the variation is. And I like to think of the law as providing a basic framework of the relationship between the landlord and the tenant, a sort of a minimum standards that everyone has to meet. So if your lease provides something that doesn't come up to that minimum standard, you still would have the protection that the law affords a tenant. However, the landlord can agree to something more than minimum standard, and so if that's the case, then the terms of the lease would apply to give you the greater protections.
Well, thank you very much. We have been speaking with Beth Godwin-Jones. She is an attorney at the Carytown Law Office in Carytown, talking about landlord-tenant law and, in particular, understanding your lease. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Marty. It's been a pleasure.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's strange but true law is from Title 54.1, which deals with professions and occupations. Under Code of Virginia Section 54.1-829, no person shall promote or conduct a boxing, martial arts, or wrestling event in Virginia without a license. Subsection D states that prior to entering the ring, a physician who has been licensed to practice medicine for at least 5 years shall examine each boxer and may examine each wrestler. Why the difference? Could it be that, as we always suspected, boxing is real and wrestling is fake? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Under legislation passed by the General Assembly, voters must present some form of identification, such as a government-issued ID, utility bill, bank statement, government check, or paycheck, with name and address. Join us next week when Randy Rollins, president of Drive to Work, unveils the mystery behind how to get a photo ID from the Department of Motor Vehicles. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright. Oh.